Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, December 19, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss the Logan Act. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back to Teleforum Professor Michael Ramsey. He's the full-time professor at the University of San Diego Law School, where he joins us from this morning in his time, this afternoon, Washington time. We're very pleased to have you with us, Professor. You've written a blog post featured on the Federalist Society's website on this same topic. I direct folks to that blog post. It might be useful even to have it in front of you as we proceed this morning or this afternoon, as the case may be. But in any event, I direct it to your attention. Take a look at afterwards. We're going to get opening remarks from the professor momentarily, but as always, we'll be turning to you for questions from the audience. So be thinking of those for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Professor Ramsey, I think you're going to start with some background and talk about the text and the original enactment of the Logan Act. Professor Ramsey.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Dean, and thanks to the Federal Society for having me to on this forum to talk about this very interesting old act. So, what we call the Logan Act is enacted back in 1799 and has not changed much since then. It's for those of you who like the official citation. It's 18 U.S. Code Section 953, and here's the operative section. Quote, any citizen of the United States, wherever he may be, who, without authority of the United States, directly or indirectly commences or carries on any correspondence or intercourse with any foreign government or any officer or agent thereof, with intent to influence the measures or conduct of any foreign government or officer or agent thereof in relation to any disputes or controversies with the United States or to defeat the measures of the United States, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 3 years or both. So the core of this is it is a prohibition on unauthorized private diplomacy with foreign nations. And the key elements are, one, a communication with a foreign government, two, without authority of the United States, and that's an important point we'll get back to later, I hope, and three, for the purposes of influencing the actions of the foreign government in relation to a dispute with the United States or of defeating U.S. policy. There's also an exemption for communications relating to personal redress of a wrong by the foreign government. I'll largely leave that aside in my remarks. But that's the essence of the act. So where did this come from? And I think that's a very interesting part of this because it is such an old statute. We have to go all the way back to 1798. To get the background of it. And at that time, as you probably know, this was the quasi-war with France, that is the undeclared naval war between the United States and France was taking place. In addition, it was a time of deep partisan divide between the Federalist Party, led by President John Adams, and a number of prominent members in Congress. The Federalists had the majority in both the Senate and the House of Representatives at the time. And then the opposition party was the Republican Party, or sometimes called the Democratic Republican Party, led by Vice President Thomas Jefferson, and in the House by James Madison. And the Federalists and the Republicans had very deep divisions on a number of issues, and one of them was about how to treat France. The Republican Party tended to be sympathetic to France, favor softer measures, and the Federalist Party, although they themselves were somewhat divided, favored stronger measures against France. So in this context, then, we meet George Logan. And George Logan was a Republican politician, state politician, and a doctor, prominent citizen in Pennsylvania. And during this time, in 1798, Logan, on his own initiative, decided he was going to solve all the problems with France. So he went over to France met with key government French government officials to try to improve U.S.-French relations. And he had some specific recommendations on some things that the French could do to try to encourage the U.S. to back down and basically just to resolve the tensions, which were not really over anything all that important. So at least in Logan's view and in the Republicans' view, it should be fairly easy to resolve. Now, the interesting thing is that the French government seemed to independently have come to the conclusion that they needed to take some actions to resolve the problems. Whether Logan had any influence on that, we don't know. But what we do know is that France started to take some of the actions, indeed, that Logan had recommended to reduce the tensions. When Logan came back to the United States, he was quite well received as being a sort of a peacemaker. At least he was quite well received by the Republicans, but he was not well received by the Federalists, who were quite upset with all this. President Adams sent a message to Congress saying he wanted Congress to pass a law prohibiting private diplomacy between the U.S. and France. Congress took that up in late 1798, and in early 1799, they passed an act that was indeed actually quite broader than just prohibiting diplomacy with France. It was the act, in essence, that I just read. It's been modified a little bit since then, but that is the act. It was passed in January of 1799, and it was actually called an Act for the Punishment of Certain Crimes Therein Specified. But that title's not very punchy, so we have come to call it the Logan Act. Indeed, it was called the Logan Act right from early on, because it was obviously a response to Logan's diplomacy. Indeed, that was quite clear right from Adams's message to Congress and from the congressional debates over it. It couldn't be applied to Logan himself, of course, because we can't have retroactive punishment of crimes. What Logan did wasn't a crime when he did it, but it was to prevent future Logans, as it were. So informally, it's been known from the beginning as the Logan Act, it's been really not modified much since then. There have been a few tweaks of the words, but basically what we are looking at is the act that was passed in 1799 in response to Logan's diplomacy. So Dean, that's where it comes from.
Good. Great background. Thank you, Professor Ramsey. So you mentioned never applied to Logan because it was couldn't be applied retroactively. How has it been applied since its enactment?
Well, the answer to that is it hadn't been applied much at all, and that brings us really to the interesting second part of the history about the Logan Act. And I think where it came from was itself quite interesting, but then the next installment of its history is that not much of anything happened with it for the next 200 years or so. So there were a couple of prosecutions, but really, actually, to the extent we've been able to figure this out, we have only found two indictments under the Logan Act ever in its history. The first one was in 1803, which is this guy in Kentucky wrote an article in a Kentucky newspaper saying that the Western territories should secede and form a separate nation allied with France. And he was prosecuted, he was indicted for a violation, among other things, in violation of the Logan Act. I actually think, I'm not sure that is a violation of the Logan Act. I think that was a pretty tenuous indictment there, because it's just a newspaper article. It wasn't, he didn't do anything like what Logan did. Flournoy was this guy's name, and he didn't do anything like what Logan did. He just wrote this article in the newspaper. So he was indicted, but then the prosecution was dropped for reasons we really don't know why, although one might speculate that it didn't really seem like it was a violation of the Logan Act. The other one that we've been able to find is in 1852, a U.S. businessman named Jacob Levy was indicted for sending a letter to the Mexican president, encouraging the Mexican president not to sign a treaty, which was then pending between the United States and Mexico. And this treaty would have had some adverse effects on Levy's businesses in Mexico. So Levy was indicted for that. That seems like a much more clear violation of the text of the act. That prosecution was also dropped, though, for the what I think is the rather amusing reason is that they couldn't get their hands, the U.S. government couldn't get their hands on the letter that Levy sent. They knew Levy'd sent the letter, but they couldn't get it. They needed that for evidence. Daniel Webster, who was Secretary of State, actually wrote to the Mexican president saying, "Could you please give us the letter?" And the Mexican president said, "No." So they couldn't get the letter, so they dropped the prosecution of Levy in 1852. No one else, so far as we know, has ever been indicted for violating the act, and no one has ever been convicted of it. And indeed, as far as we know, no indictment has been sought, or really, I think, seriously discussed, since 1852. The act has been mentioned in passing by a few courts, but these decisions don't really provide much insight, and they're not directly on point. A court did recently decide that there was no private right of action under the Logan Act. It's purely a criminal statute. As far as as a legal matter, as a criminal law matter, it's really been quite dormant for a long time. Indeed, this is interestingly, in the 1852 prosecution, there was even commentary at that point that, wow, this is an old dormant statute that's never been used. Why are we using it against this one person in 1852? And of course, we've had quite a lot of time since then. That doesn't mean the Logan Act hasn't been in the news, though. So in more modern times, while there haven't been any prosecutions, the act has been mentioned a number of times when private parties or, and actually more commonly this is how it comes up, is members of Congress have launched their own diplomatic initiatives, often in tension with what the president's trying to accomplish. There have been mentions of the Logan Act in connection with this. So, for example, in the 1980s, President Reagan had policies with respect to Central America, especially the Nicaragua, the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. Jim Wright was the Speaker of the House. He went down to Nicaragua and met with the Nicaraguan government and expressed a view of U.S.-Nicaraguan relations that was somewhat in tension with what Reagan was trying to accomplish. And Reagan complained that Wright, among other things, had violated the Logan Act. And similarly, more recent times, during the Bush administration, 2007, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi went to Syria. This is back in the day when there was some dispute about what our policy with Syria should be. President Bush was taking a hard line, and Democrats in Congress wanted a softer line. Pelosi went over to Syria and met with the president, and some people said that was a violation of the Logan Act. So it comes up in this way, it has come up in this way, in relation typically, I think, to in modern times, typically with respect to congressional diplomacy. There are sometimes some private initiatives. So back in the Reagan era, Jesse Jackson was going as a private citizen, was going around and meeting with some foreign leaders that Reagan didn't like, and Reagan didn't care for that and objected in part on Logan Act grounds. So this comes up in these prominent foreign policy disputes now and then, but this has all been political. There's never been any prosecution, or again, as far as I know, really any hint of prosecution in connection with these activities. So as a legal matter, as opposed to a political matter, I would say there's really not much to tell. I mean, the history is that it's a non-history. The statute remains on the books. As I said, it's been slightly, the wording's been tweaked a couple of times in some recodification, but there's never been any debate about it, and I don't think there was any intent to change the meaning. But it remains on the books. There periodically been some suggestions that it should be repealed, but that's not been acted on either. So it's there, but it hadn't done much as a legal matter, and as a political matter, it's been a talking point occasionally, come up, I would say, now and then, more recently. But beyond that, there's really not much to tell. And so I'm not sure if that's a good answer, but I think it's kind of interesting.
No.
That we have this statute that that's there, and what do you do? And so that's I guess the legal question for the modern day is, what do you do when you've got this statute that's been there for more than 200 years, but no one's really done anything with it? If that's where we are.
Yeah. So that gets me to my next question, and you know, you answered my second question perfectly, I thought. But so what are the arguments, about what's left of the statute today, how we ought to look at it? You know, it begins to reminds me of the collections of bizarre state statutes that remain on the books about making it a crime to walk an alligator downtown or something like that. So with regard to the Logan Act, what are the arguments left out there about its application?
Well, I think there are, I would say, really three arguments or three classes of arguments that would say that the Logan Act doesn't apply or shouldn't apply or shouldn't be applied in the modern day. And there's I'm intentionally phrasing that in slightly different ways to suggest that then you could say as a legal matter it just doesn't apply, or that as sort of as a discretionary matter it shouldn't apply. I mean, I guess the just to start the discussion off, I guess, though, the most obvious argument, starting point of the argument is, well, it's on the books, it's there, and that doesn't mean, just because it hasn't been used, doesn't mean it isn't there anymore. And similarly, same with the walking the alligators, you know, don't, just because it hasn't been used doesn't mean you should be able to walk your alligator. I mean, that's the sort of the starting, the legalistic starting point for this. But then there might be three reasons, as I say, why one might think that it's not so easy as that. And the first is really based on this this history that I've discussed of it, of non-use, that this thing, the Logan Act has not been used to prosecute anybody really ever, and it's certainly since 1852. There's actually a legal doctrine called desuetude, which means prolonged non-use. And it says is that if a statute isn't used and can fall into desuetude, and that means it really just isn't operative anymore. Now, this doctrine itself is a little bit controversial, and it does, and perhaps ironically isn't used that much. But certainly one might say that this statute's been effectively abandoned because there have not been prosecutions under it, even though people have done things, going back to Pelosi and Wright and Jackson and others. Those were just a few examples. People have done things that are quite arguably violations of the literal text of the Logan Act, but there haven't been prosecutions. It appears to be abandoned, and so you might say that as a legal matter, it isn't operative anymore. That it doesn't, especially as a criminal statute, it doesn't provide the requisite notice to people that their actions are illegal, because although it's on the books, it isn't used, and so the implication of that might be that it has been abandoned. You could also put that argument a little bit more softly and say that, well, perhaps as a technical matter, it's still operative, but as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, it's really improper to charge people under to charge a person today under an act that's been so long under such a long period of non-use that again people might well assume that it's not an operative statute anymore, and so it would not be the appropriate basis of prosecution. And I think that argument probably carries more weight with prosecutors than the technical argument, but I can't really say, not being a prosecutor. I think that might explain, though, why it hasn't been used, is that it would be, I would say, a remarkable step to bring a prosecution under the Logan Act at this point, because it's been so long without one. But in any event, so that's kind of the first category of objections to the Logan Act, is that to the use of the Logan Act today, just that it's been so long since we've used it, it's sort of fallen into disuse or desuetude, as lawyers would say. So the second argument is it's unconstitutional, and it's unconstitutional under the First Amendment. I've seen some arguments that it's unconstitutional under some other provisions, too, but I think the First Amendment argument is the one that, to me, seems to have some force. It is, after all, a restriction of speech. It says that U.S. citizens may not communicate with foreign government officials. And so if I would like to communicate with a foreign government official, I'd like to speak to a foreign government official about a dispute, Even if I'm trying to encourage the foreign official to moderate their position to settle a dispute, which is exactly what Logan was doing, then that speech is what would cause me to be prosecuted under the Act, potentially prosecuted under the Act. And so it does seem like it's a restriction on speech. And then the question is whether it can be justified under modern First Amendment doctrine. And that could take us on a long detour. But just without going too far into it, I could just say that the basic rule would be that, because it is it's a content-based restriction on speech, and it would be a question would be whether the government has a compelling interest to prohibit the speech. That's under the modern First Amendment doctrine. Does the government have a compelling interest? Well, maybe, because they do have this interest in not having U.S. diplomacy messed up by private initiatives. But on the other hand, you could imagine some correspondence with foreign governments that would be technically a violation of the Logan Act, but really you couldn't imagine causing any serious problem for the government. So whether the government has a compelling interest or not is, I think, sort of doubtful to me. I haven't looked into it a lot, but I know that someone that I respect, Professor Steve Vladek at Texas, who has been on some of these teleforums, so some of you may know him, has made this argument that the Logan Act is extremely problematic under the First Amendment. So that's your second argument why we wouldn't want to use it. And the third one, which I think is sort of most interesting given the sort of things going on in the political spectrum today, is that even if it's operative and constitutional, even if the Logan Act is operative and constitutional, that it doesn't cover people with an official or quasi-official status with the U.S. government, even if they're not speaking on behalf of the executive branch. So let's go back to the text of the Act, and what the text of the Act says is that it applies to persons who act, quote, without authority of the United States, end quote. So what does it mean to act without authority of the United States? It could mean that means without authority of the president, without approval of the president, without an approval of the executive branch. And that's certainly the way President Reagan read it when he was talking about criticizing the activities of Speaker Wright. But it seems to me that it could also be read, and people have made this argument, that it means only that it applies only to purely private people. After all, that's what Logan was himself. He was a purely private person. He had no status with the United States government whatsoever. But what about people who do have a status under the United States government, but they're not in the executive branch? And the most obvious category of this is members of Congress. So members of Congress acting in pursuance of their legislative duties do act, in a sense, with the authority of the United States government, even if they don't act with the authority of the president. Now, of course, there's going to be some debate there about what are the appropriate legislative duties of members of Congress, and whether the Constitution allows members of Congress to engage in diplomacy, or whether that's something that's exclusively an executive authority. I'll leave all that debate aside and just say that there would certainly be an argument that that at least some communications by members of Congress would be in pursuance of their legislative duties, and thus with the authority of the United States, and therefore not a violation of the Logan Act. And you would connect that up with the purpose of the Logan Act, which, as I said, didn't have anything to do with diplomacy by members of Congress. It's actually sort of doubtful that Congress would criminalize activities by itself, although I suppose it might. But really, the target of the Logan Act was purely private people, like Logan himself. Then just a further thought on that is another category of people, and this gets to really what's in the headlines of the moment, might a similar argument be made that it doesn't apply to members of a presidential transition team? And I do think there's an argument there as well, somewhat parallel to the argument that doesn't apply to members of Congress. At least it doesn't apply to all communications by members of Congress. And the argument with respect to the presidential transition team is that, again, that's an official or quasi-official part of the U.S. government, that we, the president-elect, once we've had the election, the president-elect is officially recognized status. He's not a government official as yet, but he has an officially recognized status as a result of the election, and then he designates his transition team for the purpose of smoothing the transition between the two administrations, and surely the smoothing the transition with respect to foreign affairs is one of the most important parts of the presidential transition, and we don't want to have foreign governments guessing about what the new government's going to do when it comes in, the new administration is going to do where it comes in. And the reason we have a foreign policy transition is so that we don't have big disruption and uncertainty during the transition period. And in the United States, as you know, is fairly unusual in having all this long transition period between the election and the new government, new administration taking office. In a parliamentary system, as long as they're able to form a government, they do that right away. But we have this transition period, and that's the purpose of the transition team. And indeed, this is all this is all recognized officially by statute in something called the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, which is still in the books with some amendments, which provides funding, facilities, and access to government services for the Presidential Transition Team. So it's an official recognition of the Presidential Transition Team for the purposes, again, of smoothing the transition between the two administrations. And I would assume, although I've not actually gone back and looked at this in detail, but I would assume that presidential transitions routinely have communication with foreign governments for exactly the reason that I just mentioned, that is to smooth the transition and let the foreign government know that what the outlook of the new administration is going to be. Again, that's the whole purpose of the transition as applied to foreign policy. I think that the role of the president-elect and the role of the transition team as recognized by the Presidential Transition Act and practice, which is I would assume practice would be that the transition team has had contacts with the foreign governments for all of our various presidents, and taken as well. I think going back to an earlier point I made that the Logan Act originally didn't have any of this in mind because we didn't have elaborate transition teams in those days, and indeed, it wasn't about a presidential transition or anything like that. It was about purely private activities. So you could roll all that together and say that that this really doesn't, or at least shouldn't, apply to a presidential transition. Now, that's it's not a. I don't want to make it sound like that's an ironclad argument. It's there are arguments on the other side that the text of the act doesn't have any of these exceptions, and you're sort of making these up. But I do think there is something to be said for finding an ambiguity in this. Language without authority of the United States. You got to decide what it means to have authority of the United States. So if you're looking for a textual hook for this argument about the transition team, that's it. If you're more inclined to look for a purpose or a practice hook, it would be both where the Logan Act came from, as I've talked about, and also where how it's been treated, which is it's not ever been applied to presidential transitions before. So that's kind of how it comes out in the modern time. I think a lot of this is up for debate because there aren't any court cases that are very helpful on any of this, and there's a lot of politics involved in it. But I think I'll sort of leave it at that as to sort of having put the arguments out there.
Terrific. Well, got quite a few people on the phone, so let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement. We'll say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, push the star button and then the pound button to indicate you have a question. So once again, if you have a question, our lines are wide open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're happy to take your questions. While we wait to see who might ring in, let me ask another question. I'm interested in the breadth of this, of the Logan Act. I mentioned at the outset, you have a blog post on this, on the Federal Society's blog. The language of the act is included in your blog post. It mentions, communications with foreign officials over any disputes or controversies. It doesn't, it strikes me as just being wildly overbroad. And let me ask you, since you're a professor, I'll ask you a hypothetical question. Does the act technically cover, let's just say you writing a blog post, you a private citizen, or even you in a transition, you're in the role of a transition, but you're also a professor, but you have an official role in the presidential transition. You write a blog post on a present dispute or controversy that a foreign government has with the United States. So that's a communication or correspondence. And then let's just say that it gets responded to by an official of that foreign government, and then you respond to that. Are you guilty technically under the Logan Act?
That's sort of a compound hypothetical. So as I sort of work through it, let's leave aside the transition team for a moment, because I think that raises, as I said in my opening remarks, I think that raises the question of sort of whether that's a quasi-official authority of the United States. So let's leave that aside.
Right.
Just think about me as a person writing, let's assume that just when I start off, that all I'm doing is I just write a blog post, as I have been known to do, saying that I think that U.S. policy with respect to a certain matter is misconceived, or that the foreign government would be better off if they did this, or something like that. It's just a statement of my opinion. And incidentally, that's not that different from what Mr. Flournoy did back in 1803 and got indicted for that. He's the guy who said we should have a separate Western Confederacy allied with France, and it was just a newspaper article. I'm not sure that, as I said, I'm not sure that would be even covered by the Logan Act, because I'm not sure that's a communication. That's just sort of a statement of my views. And sure, they might be reading my blog post, although that, given my readership, that's sort of unlikely. But if they were, I mean, then they would learn from that. But I don't know if I would call that, at least if I was the defense attorney, I'd say, well, that's not a communication. What a communication in the act means is actually addressing something directly to a foreign official, the way Logan did. So I think I can maybe get out of that. But I think, nonetheless, I think it's still pretty broad, in the sense that if I just am sort of talking to some foreign official, or if I'm here's one that was actually discussed as a Logan Act violation. You may recall that back in the Obama administration, when we were negotiating the agreement with Iran, that Senator Tom Cotton and some of his colleagues posted on Senator Cotton's webpage, but what purported to be a letter to the Iranian government saying, you need to understand some things about the way treaties work under the U.S. Constitution. And some people said, well, that's a Logan Act violation, because it's a communication with the foreign government with the intent to influence what they're doing. And leaving aside the official authority situation with respect to members of Congress, I think that does then seem to be covered by the literal text of it. And that suggests, as your question suggests, that it is very broad. And indeed, I think this is where the First Amendment issue comes up most strongly. It really covers some things that really seem like they would be political advocacy, where I could write an open letter as a private citizen, write an open letter to the government of Iran saying you should sign up with this agreement, or you should not sign up with this agreement. Or even if I'm traveling overseas, and I'm just this is something I think about a bit. Sometimes I travel overseas and meet with foreign officials, and it might be in just a casual conversation. Hey, what do you think about President Trump's initiative for XYZ? And if I'm taking the Logan Act seriously, I better not respond to that. Right? It's
interesting.
Because if you look at it, what it literally says, you know, any communication carries on, any communication, any intercourse, they say, but I think they don't mean what some people might think. They mean communication, right? In relation to any dispute or controversy with the United States. So then, you know, watch what you say, except that that's why it's a potential First Amendment problem. And that's why you might also, another argument might be, it's a related argument might be, that you want to read this, you know, you need to read this a little more narrowly and read it just really to apply to the kind of things that Logan did, not what just sort of what I might say to the assistant sub-provincial governor of some obscure place. It's really about something that could really be a problem for the U.S. But yeah, no, the text is quite broad if you read it literally.
Yeah, we do have, this is Dean again, we have three questions pending. I do get nervous when we have to rely on arguments about prosecutorial discretion and prosecutors looking at statutes narrowly and not enforcing them as broadly as they're written. But let's put that aside for now and let's turn to our first audience question of the day.
Hey, I have a quick question just about, in terms of procedure, let's say that they end up indicting someone on, they say, the Trump transition team, and they say, you know, the Logan Act. Do they have a right before the trial to get that reviewed by an upper court, i.e. to get the indictment thrown out saying the Logan Act, you know, let's say you go with the strategy that it's against the First Amendment? Or do they have to go through the trial first, jury instructions, everything go through, and then appeal it?
Yeah, well, that's a great practical question, and let me first of all quickly say that that I am a foreign relations expert and not a criminal trial expert. But my impression is that so you would make the motion to the trial judge, whatever that it should be dismissed on the basis of desuetude or unconstitutional in the First Amendment. Or so forth, but if the trial court grants that motion, then the government could appeal it right away because that's a final order. That would be the end of the case. But if the trial court denies the motion, then the ordinary course I think would be that you would have to proceed to trial and then appeal it, and that's why you sometimes see people doing conditional guilty pleas because they don't want to do the trial, and they do a conditional guilty plea is that you can plead guilty subject to preserving your right to appeal on the say constitutionality of the underlying statute. So my general sense is that the ordinary course would be that you would actually have to go through the trial because the denial of the of your motion to get it dismissed is an interlocutory order and it's not appealable. Now there's some exceptions to that, but I think the ordinary course is that you do have to go through the trial. I mean, that's not a statement about anything to do with the Logan Act. That's just a statement about criminal procedure, as I understand it, with the very large caveat that I'm not a criminal procedure guy.
We've got two questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take another call.
Yeah, hi. This is an interesting topic. I'm reminded of what might be the most flagrant case in history where the Logan Act could be applied, and that was Armand Hammer, the famous U.S. private citizen who spent 30 years going back and forth between the United States and the Soviet Union lobbying for peace.
Yeah. Sorry, was that I didn't know if you had any further questions. I was hesitating because I wasn't sure if you had any further question, but yes, absolutely. The couple of instances in the modern time that I mentioned were just illustrative. There have been a number of these sort of private issues, but yeah, I think that's right. I think the Armand Hammer situation is a good one because it doesn't raise the question of the whether he was had authority of the United States, because he clearly didn't. He was a private citizen. He was really a lot like Logan. I mean, that's if you think about sort of the purpose of the act and what the act was getting at. That really seemed like what he was doing was really a lot like what Logan was doing. going. He really just on all fours with it. It wasn't authorized by the United States. I wasn't completely adverse to the United States. You know, he was trying to bring peace, same as Logan was, and he wasn't a bad guy, and neither was Logan. But on the other hand, it was somewhat in tension with the official policy of the United States, which was to be sort of cautiously treat the Soviet Union very cautiously and be skeptical of general peace initiatives. So I think the Armin Hammer situation is extremely analogous to Logan. Now the question is, what do you do with that? Because he wasn't prosecuted. Hammer wasn't prosecuted, and as far as I know, there wasn't any real serious contemplation of it, although maybe there was, and I don't know even how much discussion of the Logan Act there was in connection with his activities. So the fact that he was doing this stuff in a very high-profile sort of way and didn't get prosecuted, I think contributes to the idea that the Logan Act is at least subject to the desuetude argument, or perhaps more strongly subject to the argument that it just hasn't been used, and so there's been sort of an implicit practice of ignoring it or not worrying about it. I think you could say similar things about a number of different things that Jesse Jackson was doing during the Reagan era, that purely private diplomacy, but. Some people said he was violating the Logan Act, but nothing was ever done about it. And same with Hammer. That's an excellent illustration, though.
Thank you.
This is Dean again. It's fascinating. I'm recalling what you said in your opening remarks about on destitute, that the age, I guess, and inactivity under the statute, the Logan Act, was brought up back in the 1850s when it was, I guess, last seriously contemplated its use. 170 years ago or so. Interesting. We've got just one question pending. If you'd like to join the queue, you need to push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And now we have two questions pending, so let's take our next call. Go ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Carter Page calling. I really appreciated your presentation, and coming out of the theoretical, I just wanted to get your thoughts on something. In September 2016, Representative Ted Deutsch, in a House Committee on Judiciary meeting, was asking FBI Director Comey about, a lot of the false allegations from that, dodgy Trump dossier. And he actually was pushing for him to start a Logan Act investigation against me. And again, this is sort of a month and a half before the 2016 election, and then, a couple of days after that DNC-funded dossier was put out, he actually sent another follow-up letter to Comey, sort of asking him to look into that. And I guess it sort of goes back to the point you were just discussing regarding Armin Hammer in terms of what can you do with that. I've been, given sort of the complete falsehoods that were, the basis for his arguments, I'm actually in the process of taking some action against Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was chair of the DNC at the time. And I have a number of legal arguments that I'm working through, but I'm curious to hear, I guess it's a little bit of a longer discussion, but curious to hear your general thoughts on that in terms of, obviously, there's a number of potential false evidence bases that were, inherent in that document that the DNC funded, but curious to hear your general thoughts. Thanks.
Thanks for that question. And of course, I've got to say that whatever I'm saying here, it doesn't constitute legal advice.
No.
Some parts of that question might call for some speculation away that's well away from my area of expertise. So you'll excuse me for sort of avoiding that. But I think that one thing maybe a couple of things that are notable about that the incidents that you mentioned is that first of all, it has been the case, and this experience illustrates that the Logan Act gets thrown around in sort of politicized discussions about foreign policy disputes. And there's a long history of that, at least in the modern times, going back at least to the Vietnam War era, where it doesn't come up as a prosecution matter, but it's ammunition that's thrown in when people are trying to score political points, and so that's the way it's been used. So it's not unusual it came up in this context, but it also, you might sort of discount the force of it because that's just it seems to be sort of used to score political points perhaps. And the other thing that strikes me about the episode that you're talking about is that and this goes also, I think, to Dean's question about the scope of the act, is that actually, people interact with foreign government officials a lot, whether they're people on the transition team or people just back as part of campaigns going, because what you're talking about was back before there was a transition team. But still, or even if you're thinking about the other side of that and the Fusion GPS document and the Democrats, the other side of the campaign, being alleged anyway to have been involved in producing that and perhaps that involved contacts with foreign government officials. I really don't know, the details of it are sketchy to my mind anyway. People have contact, U.S. citizens have contact with foreign officials a lot. For all sorts of reasons, and if the Logan Act was taken literally, and this was what Dean's question earlier suggested, it could apply to a lot of things. And I think it wasn't intended to have that kind of force. And if it did have, because it was really just about what Logan was doing, the type of thing Logan was doing. If it was intended to have, if it did have that kind of force, I think the First Amendment argument becomes somewhat viable, but it's really infringing on quite a range of speech. And then the final point coming out of that is that it makes the desuetude or the non-use argument again stronger, because if these kind of contacts are going on all the time and there isn't any effort to rein them in, that suggests that we're kind of treating this statute as a dead letter, or at least as something that we don't invoke in the run of the mill case. And so I think as a legal matter, that's when I see when I think about, to the extent I understand it, the episode that you're talking about, that's kind of the conclusions I get from my perspective as a foreign affairs scholar and someone who's thought about the application of the Logan Act. Some of the other things I think, if you understand, I'd prefer to stay out of, because they don't come within my area of expertise. But I think that what's been going on recently with the Logan Act is really very interesting in terms of how you would think about the application of this old act, and that it's been interesting to see this old act revived. But I think there's some reasons to think it's more a political than a legal thing, but we'll see how that comes out. I'm sure that's this is something that you're is of great concern for you and other people, that whether it becomes sort of a legal thing in the way that it hasn't been before.
It's a great laugh, actually. It's a nice prank that went awry for them, unfortunately. So, thanks.
I think we've got time for a couple more questions. We've got one question pending, so if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and the pound button on your phone. For now, let's take what appears to be the final question of the day. Oops, I think we're having a problem with our system here. Let me the caller from area code 301, your microphone should be unmuted.
This is Roger Candelaria. Thank you, Professor and Dean, for a really good presentation. The premise of my question is that we have too many laws with too many exceptions, with too many carve-outs to those exceptions. We need some kind of a mechanism to eliminate unused, unnecessary, and laws that no longer affect the purpose for which they were enacted. I wonder if you could use your fertile mind to come up with some proposals to how we might get there.
Yeah, that I think that's a great question, and it goes well beyond the Logan Act, of course, but I think it's something I'll maybe venture a couple of thoughts about, because the premise of it is absolutely true. I think that there are so many laws out there that we really don't know how they're applied, because they aren't applied very often, and so one way that the law tries to deal with it is through this doctrine of desuetude, as I've talked about. But I actually think that doctrine itself is not that helpful, because it's disputed, it's not used very often, and it's sort of unclear in what situations it applies. So there's been arguments that the Logan Act is subject to it, but there's arguments that it's not. So I'm not sure that gets you anywhere. By the way, there was an argument on desuetude specifically made to a court back in 1964, to a district court, in which they said that the Logan Act should be subject to desuetude, and the court rejected that idea. It was not a Logan Act prosecution. It was sort of a side point in a larger litigation. And the court said, no, the law's been sleeping, but it hasn't died. But they didn't really explain why, and that was a district court, and it was in 1964, which was 53 years ago, and nothing's happened with it since. So anyway, one way to deal with it, one way to answer your question, is to say, well, doctrine of desuetude will do it. But I don't think that actually does it, because it's not clear enough how it works. Second thing is, what we could have, and I think this proposal has been made from a number of quarters, is that have more broadly the idea of sunset laws. That is, that a law has an effective period, and after that, unless it's reenacted, it just goes away. And that, I think, does I think that does really make some progress on this issue, because it puts the default or the momentum the other way. I mean, now it's the law sits there unless somebody gets rid of it. And as I mentioned, there have been a couple initiatives over time, including in modern times, to actually repeal or at least substantially revise the Logan Act. But they haven't gone anywhere, because the difficulty of getting things done in Congress in this situation weighs against any action on it, because you can't get the revision through, and if you don't get the revision through or the repeal through, then it sits there. So a sunset law reverses that, as you know, and I think there's even though Congress would surely reenact a lot of things sort of automatically, nonetheless, I think a sunset law would change the a broad sunset law, that is, saying that sunset provisions is broadly applicable to federal statutes. I think that would go some way to doing it. I think it's probably a hard sell to Congress, but I think that would probably be my feeling, is that's the way to look if you're concerned about these kind of things. And I suppose the third way to do it would be to say that there's some kind of a constitutional violation. Some people said this about the Logan Act, too. There's some kind of a constitutional violation not under the First Amendment, but more broadly under due process, that when we have these acts sitting around, nobody knows what they mean. Nobody knows if they'll ever be used. It doesn't give people fair notice as to what as a practical matter is prohibited and what's not. So that argument's been advanced, but it hasn't gotten a lot of momentum. And again, it's been advanced in connection with the Logan Act, but it hasn't got a lot of momentum.
Thank you.
Thank you, caller. We've got a couple minutes left. If anyone has a final question, now's the time to ask it by pushing the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Well, we're waiting to see if anybody. Oh, we do have another question. We've got about 5 minutes left, so let's see if we can squeeze this in.
Hi, this is Mike Caldwell. I was wondering whether there's a better, and I just joined this conversation late, so if you already talked about this, I'm sorry. I was wondering whether there's a better case for violation of the Logan Act against Hillary Clinton and her campaign, because of their obvious consorting with the Russians to influence the election.
Yeah. Well, again, I, I'm I think I would be careful myself about making any factual statements because I don't really know the facts. But I think that they're potentially, absolutely, that if there were contacts between the Clinton campaign and the Russian government, and they were, well, you have to look at the particular language of the statute, but if they were in relation to any dispute with the United States, or if they were to defeat measures of the United States, now I suppose that influencing the campaign wouldn't be the second one, but it might well be the first one, in relation to any disputes or controversy with the United States. That's extremely broad. So I think that potentially there could be, again, as I indicated, perhaps with connection with a Fusion GPS thing or otherwise. But that also, to me, raises a question about whether that's really what the Logan Act is supposed to be doing, because it's a far afield from what Logan himself was doing, what the purpose of the act was. It is something that is probably happens a fair amount, not to necessarily to influence the election, but I would think that contacts between not just transition teams, which are that raises the authority of the United States point, but leave aside transition teams, which I think are an easier argument to say that doesn't apply, but just presidential campaigns. I would think the presidential campaigns probably do have contact with foreign government officials, or at least they make statements that could be construed as messages to foreign governments. They certainly campaigns make statements about foreign policy all the time. Now, that's different from trying to influence the election, but I think that if you're trying to influence the election, that might be that might be subject to prosecution under some other statutes, but it's really not what the Logan Act was about. I mean, the Logan Act was about interfering with the foreign policy of the United States. But at the same time, I think that we certainly accept and have accepted for a long time that campaigns, not just transition teams, but campaigns, make statements about foreign policy, say things that that may well be designed to influence the foreign governments. Is that really a Logan Act problem? And if it is a Logan Act problem, why hasn't it been prosecuted before? So I guess I would be cautious about trying to apply this to a campaign. But certainly if it applies to one campaign, it should apply to all campaigns. And that's, I think there's a real, this is not necessarily a legal thing, but it's certainly an optics thing about trying to apply it to one campaign or one transition team and not to others.
So it would apply to the what was alleged against Nixon with his contacts with Tew prior to his election in 1968.
Well, by the text, it was yes. Although I think some of that was after he was elected. So that once he's president-elect, then there's the additional argument that maybe he actually does have the authority of the United States, but. At least in the connection with the transition, but if it's before the election, I think it is covered by the literal text of the act, I guess is the way I'd put it. And then the question is whether combining the purpose and the practice and the history of non-use, whether that's whether that would make it whether that would create an exception, but. But yeah, I think, and especially once you're talking about an initiative that's really designed to be really counter to what the current administration is trying to accomplish, that starts getting over into real actual Mr. Logan activities, right? So I think I'd need more details on exactly when it happened and what Nixon was up to. There would be an argument, sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. So, you know, when you explore more and more of these hypotheticals, you really do begin to appreciate the breadth of some of the language in the Logan Act and just how how broadly it could be applied, which I suppose goes to your desuetude arguments, but also the due process arguments you raised. Any final thoughts before we adjourn, Professor?
I think it's been a good discussion, and I don't really have that much to add. I think it's just, for me, it's just really interesting to see an old statute like this suddenly become in the spotlight, and then the question is, what do you make of it? And I think that's not an easy question to answer, especially when you have something that just is sort of sat on the books for a long, long time without doing anything, and then all of a sudden we're thinking about, well, what can we do with it? And it makes for an interesting thing for professors anyway, and for those people who are more immediately affected by it. I feel for them because it's hard to know what to make of it. And I guess that's sort of the way that's the way I would leave it.
Right. Hard to know what to make of it. Not a good status for a criminal statute. But,
not a good status for a criminal statute. I guess let me just add one more thing that actually when you say that strikes me is that, again, I'm not a criminal lawyer, but I come with this a little bit because I have an association with Justice Scalia, or had an association with Justice Scalia. And one thing that Justice Scalia believed in very firmly on the criminal side, and you know, he was known as a conservative, but actually he was sometimes a friend to the criminal defendant. And one thing he really pushed, among others, was the idea of the rule of lenity. And what he said was that the rule of lenity, if it's not clear that a criminal statute covers something, then it shouldn't cover it, because people need to be on notice as to what is prohibited and what is not. And he felt very strongly that was a core consideration of the criminal law. And he got through it more through the rule of lenity than he did through due process, but he also had the idea of that there was a due process implication of it. So I think maybe that's a good place to end it there. I think that's an excellent point, is that we're not talking about just some civil statute here. There's criminal sanctions at stake here, and that when the answer is we don't know what to make of it, that is troubling.
Well, always good to end on a note from Justice Scalia. So my thanks to Professor Ramsey, again, not just for today, but for the blog post as well. I commend that to your attention, to the caller's attention, on the Federal Society's website. So thank you, Professor Ramsey. Also, my thanks to the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder to check our website and monitor your emails for upcoming teleforum conference calls. But until that next call, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.